The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org. Good evening, everybody. It's very nice to be here. Nice to see you all. A funny thing just happened to me as I was offering incense at the altar. Never happened to me ever before. And I've offered incense there quite a few times. Bokushu handed me the stick of incense, and I went to place it in the bowl. And as I placed it down, I guess it's like 2 hours meeting in midair, I must have touched the tip of an old stick that was in there. And as I pushed this stick down, another stick popped up. Never know what's under, what's being covered up. So I wanted to talk tonight about an experience that happened to me recently and try to fold that into a koan and a movie. If any of you have seen me give talks, I always fall back on movies for some reason. But so anyway, I'll begin with the experience. And just a little background, because I don't know everybody here. So for those of you that don't know me, I'm also a professional jazz musician, and I have been for about, I guess about 30 years, 30 years or so, 25 and 30 years. When I was sitting, I was thinking about it. Was it before I graduated college, or was it somewhere around that time? So it's about 30 years I've been a professional jazz musician. And it was just a couple months ago, I was called to play this concert, this show in Washington, D.C. at this club that I'd been hearing about, you know, my whole life. It's kind of a famous club. It's called Blues Alley. There was some famous live records recorded there, and it was going to be the first time I ever played there. And also in the band was going to be someone who was, I wouldn't say a hero of mine, but someone that when I was in college I really looked up to and listened to his records all the time. So I was going into this situation of really excited to play at this club for the first time, and also really excited to play with this guy for the first time. And so I showed up, so, you know, we got down there, and, you know, we had the sound check and everything, and we were going to have two sets. So the first set, it was kind of just like a little bit of the same old BS that always, like, pops up in my head. And a lot of times in my experience, especially when it comes to, creative improvisation, you know, creatively, spontaneously making up something in the moment. And, you know, maybe it was because I was nervous to play in front of this person or nervous to play at this club. But I was really in my head. And, you know, this is something that has happened countless, countless times throughout my career. You know, where the little critic is whispering behind my ear. Every time I play something, he would let me know what he thought of it. And, you know, this, like I said, the same old, that spiral. Once that critical voice is noticed, and I grab onto it even a tiny bit, I don't even have to grab onto it, just stick to it a tiny bit, then what happens is I listen to that voice, and while I'm listening to that voice, time is passing. And when time is passing, music is passing that I'm not focused on. And so there goes another moment down the toilet, and then there's that critic talking again, right? So it's this constant kind of, when you get caught in it, it's kind of a spiral, a downward spiral. So I was feeling quite frustrated after this set. And I think I usually would try to come up with some kind of a strategy in my mind. I'll try to like find some kind of strategy, like, okay, what am I going to do to get out of this for the next set? Or what am I going to do to, you know, I was always looking for a way out, in a sense. And I don't exactly know what happened, but I kind of described it where somewhere inside me, and I don't know, I don't remember the exact moment that this happened, but somewhere inside me, I called it the fuck it switch. I flicked the fuck it switch. And when I went back to the stage the second time, and this was, you know, I'm telling you, 30 years of doing this. And I get back to the stage, and I flick that fuck it switch, and the first song, I remember the first song very well. And I just, with that flicking that switch, I decided that I was going to take the risk. I was going to take a chance. I said, you know what? The first set, and mind you, this is all going on inside of me. I don't know what the perception was of my playing. Maybe people liked it the first set. I don't really know. But we're always our worst critic, right? But it is also about the experience. So I decided to not care, in a sense. I decided to not care about what I played in terms of the content, right? Because a lot of times, in the jazz world, there's a lot of ways to do things that are very verbose or seemingly like complicated. You know, it's easy to like kind of get into these areas where you can try to show off how much knowledge you have. And that's what I decided to throw out the window. And I said, you know what, take it or leave it. This is who I am, and this is what I'm going to do right now. And at a certain point in the middle of the set, I realized I was having fun. That was one thing. I realized I was having a lot of fun, and I also realized that the voice wasn't there, and I also realized that that I liked what was happening. I liked what was going on. And so I have also been, as I was sitting, I was realizing I did my first retreat, my first full session, it was Zen session 15 years ago. And something that, and if you haven't ever been on a Zen retreat, it can be quite intimidating. You know, as I remember entering my first retreat, knowing that I was going to sit down on this cushion for like many, many hours per day, and I wasn't going to talk to anybody, I was going to be completely silent, I wasn't allowed to look at anybody. You know, it's like all these things, you know, one day is fine, but you finish one day, you're like, oh my God, there's going to be six more days of this, or whatever. You know, it's quite intimidating sometimes. And I can tell you that after 15 years, I still feel that. I still feel that nervousness. I still feel that, you know, ambivalence. You know, there's still some little voices in there that say, you don't need to be here, you know, or you don't need to be here this time. Or, you know, all those little things that want to pull me out. But something that I experienced is... at a certain point, again, I don't know exactly when this happened, but my body knew. My body knows that if I go into a Zen retreat, if I go into a session, after a few days, maybe even after one day, of feeling that ambivalence, I'm going to settle in and I'm going to be eternally thankful and grateful that I'm there, and it's going to be the experience I need. I trust in my body that it's going to be the experience I need, and I know that in a deeper place. I know that not in my mind. I don't know that in my mind because my mind is still trying to tell me to get out of there. But I know somewhere deeper in my body. And I might even call that a belief because it's not knowledge. It's like I have a very strong belief. I know that if I go into a Zen retreat, I'm going to end up having a good experience. I'm going to be happy that I went there. So a very similar thing happened to me this evening in Washington, D.C. For the very first time, I felt this belief in my body, a belief in myself, that I've been playing this music for a long time, and even if I make a mistake, quote unquote, I've been doing this for a long time. I'm gonna know what to do with it. I'm gonna know what to do with that mistake. I'm gonna listen to that quote-unquote mistake and see where it takes me. I'm going to listen to the next note, and I'm going to listen. And somehow or another, I just was in it. That's the way I like to describe it. I described it to my music students that way, too, that's what really being in it is. So that's the experience. And I've been carrying that with me ever since. And I do completely believe that something happened that night. I'm not exactly sure, but something happened when I flicked that switch. Or it was flicked for me. I'm not exactly sure quite how it happened. But every time I've played since then, it's been different. There's been a different quality to the energy that I bring into the playing. And I really attest it to this one experience. But that one experience, like I'm saying, was one experience along a line of many, 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 many experiences. So there's this koan. That's a koan that's very early in our literature. It comes up a few times. And this was one of the very first koans that I had a kind of a deep experience with, and it's called Kyogen's Man Up a Tree. And it goes like this. Master Kyogen said, "It's like a man up a tree who hangs from a branch by his mouth. His hands cannot grasp a bough. His feet cannot touch the tree. Another man comes under the tree and asks the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West. If he does not answer, he does not meet the questioner's need. If he does answer, he will lose his life. At such a time, how should he answer?" I remember someone who was a student of Maizumi Roshi coming and giving a talk here one day and saying that there would be many times when they would be sitting with Maizumi, and Maizumi would say to the group, maybe shout to the group, I would imagine, something like, today you will die on the cushion. Today, while we're here, you will die on the cushion. And so I'm connecting that with this part of the koan where he says, if he answers, he will lose his life. So what does that really mean? In Muon's comments, he says, first line, he says, "Even though your eloquence flows like a river, it is to no avail." So that eloquence floating like a river, for me that was like in the first set, trying to show all that I knew, trying to show all the fancy stuff that I could play, trying to show my eloquence. But in the second set, I lost my life. I was no longer carried up in all my bullshit. It dropped away. It was gone. And when that happens, you won't be so afraid to open your mouth and fall. Like the man up who was hanging from the tree. So I felt like that experience that happened to me in Washington, D.C. was a very kind of visceral expression of this koan. It was very, I really felt it very deeply. And for the first time, kind of had an inkling into this idea of what dying on the cushion or losing one's life means. Because we hear this in Zen a lot. Muwan goes on to say, if you can really answer it, you will revive the dead and kill the living. If, however, you are unable to answer, wait for Maitreya to come along and ask him. So Maitreya is the Buddha who is yet to come. So he's not here right now. So just wait. Do we really want to wait? No. I was tired of waiting. I was so damn tired of waiting. So I wanted to fold that into a movie that I saw recently that had a profound effect on me also. This movie is called Free Solo. I'm not sure if anyone has seen it. I'm not sure if it's still in the theaters, but it won this year's Oscar for the best documentary. And it's about a rock climber who is one of these, you might call them lunatics, who are in this small category of people who want to climb these mountains and these rocks straight up without any ropes, without any protection. And if any of you have ever been to Yosemite, the movie is about that he's planning to become, or he's considering and training to possibly become the first person to free solo El Capitan, which is the largest. It's kind of the way they speak about it in the movie. It seems like it's kind of the epicenter of the rock climbing world. And to a layman, I could look at any like kind of flat wall going up and think like, wow, anyone is crazy if they're going to do that. But this wall in particular, even all of the professional climbers in the world say, there's no way in hell I would ever do that. So this one guy is planning to do this. And the movie is wonderful. It's not just like a documentary about a sporting event. You know, it gets into the relationship he has with the film crew, because the film crew are also all climbers, and they're all supportive of him, but they're all also afraid that they're going to film their friend falling to his death. And he also has a new relationship, and his girlfriend also is very supportive of his passion, and yet doesn't want to lose him. So what I found very powerful about this guy, he's, as you can imagine, he's a little weird. There's got to be something a little strange about you if you want to risk your life so much like that. But he was going out to, he would spend the whole season in Yosemite. He would just live in his van. He had like a little minivan that he would live in. He'd do his pull-ups on the door of the van. And he was going up and down that El Capitan every day. And I don't know exactly how many times he climbed it with ropes before finally making this. Well, actually, and the interesting thing is that he did try it once, free, without the ropes. And as he got about a quarter or third of the way up, I think they maybe had a microphone on him, and you heard him go, "Ah, this sucks. I don't want to be out here." And he called it off. Helicopter had to come pick him up, or something had to come to save him. And then he gave it up, and then it just didn't stop eating away at him. So the next season, he went back. But he knew every single inch of that hill, up inside and out. He knew every move that he was going to make. He wasn't just gonna the hell with it, you know, throw caution to the wind and get, you know, he was very, very meticulous. After every day of practice, he had these books where he would write logs in, and you would watch. He'd write these little lines, and like he'd write and write and write and write. He'd write about what the problem areas were. He'd write about what he needed to do physically to get through certain areas. He wrote about what was holding him back mentally and psychologically. It was like he was very present with his practice of climbing this hill with the ropes. He was very practiced of everything, and he was very aware of the dangers. And you're also really introduced to what those parts of the hill are. So when it comes time, when he finally does it, it's like, oh, he's reaching that point, oh, he's reaching that point. These very difficult parts. And so I was balancing this out with this idea of just feeling it, you know, just like, you know, feeling something that's right. And it's interesting because he didn't set a date. He wasn't like, I'm going to climb it on Thursday morning, or I'm going to climb it next week. He didn't really know when it was going to happen. He could tell when it was getting close. And that was, ironically, that was one of the few times where you saw him express emotion. He saw him kind of get giddy. Besides that, he was kind of pretty deadpan. But when he finally made the decision, he didn't tell anybody. He just went to the mountain and started climbing. And people, and then you heard them getting on the walkie-talkies, like, he just started climbing. He's on. So the camera crew like got into gear and started following him. So not only was he, the very interesting thing I found was, so first of all, the quality of doing something like this, oh, I'm getting a cramp. The quality of doing something like that without the ropes, and we could think about what that might mean, is obviously an extremely different experience, right? And he speaks about that in the movie, that he's, you know, he climbed that mountain at least 100 times with ropes. But doing it without ropes is always going to mean an incredibly different experience. What I was very taken by was how, when he was doing it without the ropes, I never saw a moment of hesitation, especially when he got to those trouble spots. It's like he didn't get to, and you get to know what the movie's going to do. You would think that he might sit there and like, take a breath and like, no. It was like from the moment he started to the moment he gets to the top. I'm sorry, I'm ruining the movie for you, but it would be pretty dark film if he didn't make it to the top. But from the time he starts to the time he gets to the top, there's not a moment of hesitation. And I talk about this with my students because I would tell them that when we're in the practice room and when we're also rehearsing, we have the ropes on. And every time we go onto the stage and it's time to perform, the ropes are off. And in a certain matter, it is a matter of life and death, in a certain way of seeing things. It is a matter of life and death. And I think that we all feel that when we witness beautiful works of art, that the person creating that art is coming from that place, where it's a matter of life and death, you know? And he was doing this, you know, well aware of that. It was literally a matter of life and death for him. Where I think for all of us, we can consider what it might mean for us to take the ropes off. And what does that mean? Because I kind of feel like that's really what our whole life is, and we don't realize it. I also think that I might say that during that first set in Washington, D.C., I was trying to strap all kinds of ropes all over the place and chisel things in here and chisel things in there. And what happens when you do that? Hesitation. Doubt. Hesitation. Not feeling sure. And what happened in that second set was the ropes were just gone. And I may have fell a few times. Luckily, playing the piano is not a death-defying act. But it was that same experience where I feel like he had lost his life while he was climbing that mountain, just like I lost my life on that second set. And just like if you want to answer that person from the tree, we have to lose our lives. And I also was thinking that we could also look at, in a sense, practice is with ropes. Life is without ropes. And so kind of when we leave here, when we come in here, maybe it's like we're scaling our lives with ropes on these cushions. But then when we walk out the door, there's no more ropes. So I think it's very nice to find a way to flick the fuck it switch if you can. And I want to leave you with one of my favorite things. I know I've used this at least in one Dharma talk before, but this is one of my favorite things. This is a letter, excerpt from a letter that Martha Graham wrote to someone. And she says, "There is a vitality, a life force, a quickening that is translated through you into action. And because there is only one of you in all time, this expression is unique. And if you block it, it will never exist through any other medium and be lost. The world will not have it. It is not your business to determine how good it is, nor how valuable it is, nor how it compares with other expressions. It is your business to keep it yours clearly and directly, to keep the channel open. You do not even have to believe in yourself or your work. You have to keep open and aware directly to the urges that motivate you. Keep the channel open. No artist is pleased. There is no satisfaction whatever at any time. There is only a queer, divine dissatisfaction, a blessed unrest that keeps us marching and makes us more alive than the others." Have a wonderful evening.